And we move on to the economy now, and the next question comes from Duncan Gibbons. And the question is, how do you intend to balance economic growth and the needs of the environment? And a related question from Kate Metcalf. How should the next government create a green, caring economy for all? Do we need to move away from a narrow focus on GDP to focus on the well-being of people and the planet? And we're going to start with Sophia.
Nick, can you just repeat the first question? Sorry,
yes, of course.
I'm still thinking, I've forgotten the first part already.
How do you intend to balance economic growth and the needs
of
the environment?
Yes, of course. I said it a couple of times already, it's worth repeating just because it sits at the core of our pledge and our manifesto. Those five missions that we've set, at the heart of them, side by side, is being able to kickstart economic growth and deliver a green energy superpower and all of those commitments that we've spoken about earlier. And the two go hand in hand. I reject the critique from some that you cannot have economic growth without somehow giving up on your environmental credentials, or vice versa, which is what we often hear, which is don't go green, we'll all go poor. And the truth is, actually, if you have an industrial strategy that at its heart is driven by the opportunities that a green revolution can bring, then the two go hand in hand. We create new skills for swathes of the population that currently are unemployed. 1 in 8 young people currently is not in school, not in training. We are able to then create the skills to plug into these emerging areas of workforce requirement in order to drive the newer technologies, or to drive, as we talked about earlier, the Warm Homes Plan, or GB Energy, or indeed GB Rail, or any of those other things I mentioned. Those two go hand in hand, and I'm absolutely adamant, and I wouldn't be sat here today, Nick, at all if I didn't think this was true, that actually our economic future and our prosperity as a nation is reliant entirely on our ability to deliver on the green agenda.
Thank you. Daisy.
So the first thing to say is that economic growth is not the same as consumption. And I think when people ask the question about how do you balance the economy with the environment, often that's the point that they're getting at. You can reduce consumption whilst also improving economic growth, and we have to do that. So the first thing is we need an industrial strategy. The government scrapped their industrial strategy in 2021 and haven't replaced it. So we need an industrial strategy that puts climate jobs of the future right at its heart. And by doing that, we can reduce our energy usage, we can have a fair transition, and we can create climate jobs and have economic growth. The second thing is that we need a lot of infrastructure in this country. We need a lot of infrastructure, whether that's the grid, whether it's rail, whatever it might be. But we want to make sure that the National Infrastructure Commission has a remit to look at the environmental impact of infrastructure. Many of you will know that here in St Albans, we've been told we have to have a strategic rail freight interchange the size of 490 football pitches. Now, we know that in order to get freight off the roads and onto rail, we need to have freight interchanges somewhere. But you don't whack it between two tiny little villages, increase traffic by 4,000 lorries a day without an access route onto the M25. It is absolutely the worst place to do it. And we've got to be really sensitive that where we have the infrastructure that we need to tackle the climate emergency, that it is sensitive to the local environment. Otherwise, people will turn against it. Last point on GDP. Yes, we should have many more metrics. Some of you will know about the Gini coefficient, the gap between the richest and the poorest. There's the happiness index, people's access to nature. There are lots of different things that we could be measuring better than just GDP on its own.
Thank you. James.
Give you a stat to kick off with. I was born in 1990. Over the course of my lifetime, we have cut emissions by 50% and grown our economy by 80%. You can grow economies and cut emissions. Net zero is not a bar to that. And in fact, net zero is the fastest growing part of our economy. I think last year it generated something like 74 billion to the economy. The jobs that they create are on average £10,000 better paid than the average. So it is not a barrier, and we should not see it as a barrier. And the final thing I would say on this is that the reasons not to act are just don't go there, because the world is changing, the climate is changing, we are in a climate emergency. The cost of inaction is much worse.
Thank you, James. Simon.
Well, a lot of those emissions that the government tells you they've cut have been exported, of course. Someone else is emitting those and then putting them on ships and emitting more to bring those goods back to us. That's another story, perhaps. Yes, of course, GDP was only made up as an idea a few decades ago. It's one measure. It's quite a useful measure. But, you know, famously, if there's an oil spill, that increases your GDP because it costs money to clear it up. And so that's good for the economy. So it's obviously bonkers. It's certainly bonkers just to have GDP as the only thing that you ever focus on. There are, again, loads. Go and have a look at the manifesto if you haven't seen it already. Loads and loads of policies in there which are about creating green jobs. You know, the insulation program I talked about will create thousands and thousands of jobs that are also good for the environment. And new houses, if we build new low carbon houses, that will create jobs as well, in addition to what we already have. The whole renewable energy program we've already talked about this evening, that will create good green jobs. And costing in the pollution and the damage that some other industries do, that we mentioned already before, that is not currently paid for. I'm making people pay, making the polluter pay. This is not a moral point. This is just, it's just unfair. Some industries are paying and some aren't. And, you know, the idea of airport growth, which I think both the major parties are still in favour of, is a really good example here. You can say, oh, we're creating all these jobs in airports and we're flying around and we're creating, money is circulating through the system. But all the costs and all the pollution, the effects on health, the effects on nature, and the effects on the climate, none of those are costed into that. So we want to see a shift in the kind of tax and system that makes that stuff a bit more fairer and a bit greener.
Thank you, Simon. We're going to move on to nature now, and the next question comes from Anna Barrett.
I was one of the people from St Albans who joined tens of thousands more in London last Saturday, asking the government to restore nature now. If elected, what would your party do to reverse the biodiversity loss?
And a related question from Stephen Marcus.
How would you address the lack of connection to nature that has led us to a situation where our physical and mental health are threatened?
And we'll start with Daisy.
So, first things first, we'd end the sewage scandal. That's number one thing, because actually the sewage scandal is so bad for our biodiversity in our rivers and in the surrounding area. We would have binding targets to halt the decline in our nature. We've got a commitment in our manifesto to double nature, the protected nature areas, by 2050. We would plant 60 million trees a year. We'd have a Clean Air Act. And we'd want to work closely with the European Environment Agency as well. There are lots of things that we can do. Anna, I'm so pleased that you went on that march. I know many people here and elsewhere who did. And I think it's incredibly powerful when people take part in peaceful protests to show the strength of feeling about this issue. It's really devastating that, you know, we're quite lucky here in St Albans. We've got a beautiful river, we've got some lovely parks, we've protected green spaces. But there are many parts around the country where people have no connection to green spaces at all. They don't even have a few trees on their street. And so one of the things you can do is you can actually use planning. Planning often sounds a little bit boring, but you could use the planning framework to put requirements in place that local authorities have to guarantee nature to local people. They have to guarantee that children have access to nature. You have to give the resources and the powers to local authorities to plan their tree routes, because it's fine having a forest, but there's no point having a forest 2 miles up the road if there isn't the trees that connect it and create a wildlife corridor. So actually we should be setting targets centrally in Westminster, but giving powers and resources to local authorities to create those local green spaces and to give people access to nature right on their doorstep.
James.
It's a shocking fact that the UK is one of the most nature-depleted countries, not just in Europe, the world. We've lost something like 97% of key species since 1970. We've lost so much of our 17% of key species since 1970s, 95% of our wildflower meadows, 80-something percent of our ancient woodlands. These are not minimal figures. These are huge, huge tasks to overcome, which is why the government has set strong targets in place to improve nature. We've committed £650 million to tree planting. There's legally binding targets now set. In fact, going back to what I was saying earlier about the environmental land management systems, we are encouraging farmers through the tax system and through incentives to increase biodiversity through regen agriculture. So the government is working on this, and it's not just a priority for the government, it's a massive priority for me as well.
Thank you, James. Simon.
Yes, one of the questions was about, you know, connecting to nature, and I think that's the clue really, or one of the answers is, you know, if we can allow ourselves and our fellow Britons to connect better to nature, then we will protect it. We will want to protect it. We'll be close to it. One of the things we talked about in our manifesto is a right to roam act. So rather than having needing permission to go onto land as a default, you can go onto it by default unless the rules say that you can't. We think that would make a big difference. A really imaginative thing, I think, is to include growing and cooking as part of the school curriculum to make sure that children understand their connection with nature in that way and not think that beans are things that come out of tins. We would support farmers, as we've talked about, to farm in a more nature-friendly way so that they are naturally improving the soil and the environment, because rather than relying so much on chemicals, which of course have, you know, poisoned our rivers, that's the main cause, they're actually doing something which they all want to do in a more nature-friendly way. And yes, that's going to take subsidies, different kinds of subsidies than the ones that we've got now, but it's about making that connection to nature. We'd give £3 billion in annual grants, is what we're proposing, to farmers, to support them in doing that, turning to regenerative farming, as James was talking about, and returning some of their land to nature, and just farming in a way that is more in tune with the environment around them. And that will have ripple effects, I think. Those sorts of things will enable us to just appreciate that we are people of nature, and therefore it's up to us to look after that nature. Thank you, Simon.
Sophia.
Thank you. And thank you for asking the question. I think quite a lot of times in these sorts of debates, people very rightly, in some respects, talk a lot about the emissions programme and net zero. And somewhere along the line, people have started to realise actually the crucial nature that both our biodiversity but also our blue agenda plays into the overall health and well-being of the planet is absolutely essential. And with that in mind, we are committed to delivering the targets in the Environmental Act. I think it's absolutely important that we're able to do that. We're committed to that, as I mentioned earlier, 30 by 30, which is all about the diversity of our ecological environment by protecting spaces such that they can really flourish. And then creating those spaces. So for each of the regions across Britain, we will, and we've committed the funds to do this and made a pledge, one river walk across each one of those, tied into our water management programme that I talked about earlier in terms of cleaning up our rivers, three national forests. And why is that important? Does it feel a bit like a fad? Not really, because it comes back to this question about connectedness. I lived in Stoke. There was no national forest near Stoke. You know, the first time I saw a tree that wasn't in a pot somewhere and looked a bit false was probably when I left the city and came elsewhere to places that were more based within nature. And that takes me on to, or actually I should mention very quickly, there's also earmarked investment into can I finish my work? Can I finish the words? Because they'll obviously be hanging on those.
Yes, go on.
Really, rich habitats, so such as peat bogs and so on, to ensure that we're able to protect and also grow the biodiversity there.
Thank you, Sophia. And we'll come on to our next topic now, which is resilience. The next question comes from Chantal Burns. And the question is, what firm, non-negotiable climate adaptation and resilience policies will you be championing in the coming 2 years? And a related question from Farhat Zia.
Thank you. 2 weeks ago, I returned from Pakistan, where I saw at first hand what flash flooding and temperature above 40 and 45 degree do to these community. What provision would your party have in place to tackle the changes caused by climate change in Hertfordshire, such as the recent rainfall and flooding?
Thank you. James.
This goes back to one of the things I said earlier in terms of resilience. One of the long-term issues that we have got to get to grips with is climate-based migration. And as you were saying, in Pakistan, the flooding there has been absolutely horrendous. And the, I think something like 30, 40 million people have been displaced because of that. The numbers of people that are going to be moving around the world when certain parts become uninhabitable because of floods or because of extreme temperatures, we have got to get to grips to it and get ahead of the curve now. And quite frankly, it's got to be a cross-party issue. It cannot just be a political football. And for too long, migration has been a political football. And it's time that sensible people get round a table and make sensible discussions, future-proofing the system, because we can't just go on with this standard issue, blame the other, a type approach to immigration, especially when we're going to be dealing with 200-300 million people displaced from their homes in the next 20 to 30 years.
Simon.
In terms of adaptation and resilience, I think again, a lot of the things, probably maybe all the things we talked about this evening, have relevance to that. So certainly in terms of, you know, food and farming policy, we've talked about the idea that actually we need to be more resilient as a nation, more self-sufficient right away, but also just in case our food supply is affected by climate change. James touched on migration and immigration there. One of the things that we would do as a party is increase foreign aid, not decrease it, because peace is the best way to stop people from moving from country to country. And if you're in a part of the world where climate change is inevitably going to make where you live uninhabitable, we need to help those areas to adapt faster than we're going to need to, because as you say, there are places in the world already 45, 50 degrees, this is getting pretty unlivable. So what do we do as a country to help them? That's both a question of just natural justice, but also self-interest, because you don't want billions of people moving across the world and all the problems that creates, chiefly for them, but also for the people who are asked to help them. I think, you know, flooding and housing are issues that feed into this. So, you know, we do have a flooding problem even in St Albans in our own small way. But certainly the way that we build houses needs to be more resilient, more adaptive, both, as I said earlier, in terms of resisting heat that's coming, but also in terms of being more self-sufficient in energy with local energy supplies and the national grid upgrade.
Thank you. Sophia.
Cool. Thank you, Nick. So local adaptation is absolutely vital, because even though we will try as hard as we can to arrest climate change, we are seeing the impacts of climate change locally, nationally, and internationally across nations. So we have to invest. We cannot dither and strangle off the finances that have gotten in the way of local communities being able to build resilience into their systems. The plans that we have look to ensure that we give power to local communities so that we can develop resilience plans and adaptation plans for local communities based on local needs and infrastructure. Might be that a particular river course used to take a particular route and it keeps wanting to return to that route. Those sorts of decisions need to be made locally, informed by local experience, so that we can build resilience into the system for the long term. Building houses that are capable of withstanding some of these stresses and strains, whether it be flooding, or whether also, Simon, you touched on it earlier, increasing heat levels, being able to insulate our homes, both to keep them warm, but also to keep them cool so it remains habitable. These are adaptations that need to be built into the strategy of development rather than stand alone. James, since you've mentioned the migration relationship, the global adaptation, which is how I might describe it, requires a couple of things. It requires us to have a posture of international cooperation and not one of blaming others, talking about borders and threats.
Thank you, Chair. Daisy.
So three things, if I have enough time. The first is that the Committee on Climate Change issued a report in March of this year which talked about climate resilience, and there was good news and bad news. The bad news is that the government is progressing fewer than half of the short-term actions that it committed to progress on climate resilience. The good news, however, is that in the coming months, we're going to be entering what's called price control periods. And that means that the government can talk to the energy providers, to the rail providers and to the water companies and can talk about price control. And as part of that process, they can build in climate resilient demands. So I think that over the next few coming months, there could be a really important opportunity for the next government, whatever that government looks like. The second thing on rainfall and flooding, I'm afraid that comes down to planning again, both national planning and local planning. It's deeply frustrating for me, and I think for many local councillors, that local councils are not able to have higher standards than the national government allows them to have. And we know around here already that there's a huge problem with runoff. As soon as there's any rainfall at all, people get water in their garages, they get it into their homes, and we can't, you know, we're not able to actually demand higher standards than what the government says we're allowed to do. We see that in many places. And the third thing is the international point, Farhat, as well. Liberal Democrats are committed to reversing the cuts to international development budget. We would revert that back up to 0.7% of GNI. And we would also continue to contribute to the loss and damage fund to make sure that, you know, countries that are suffering irreparable harm as a result of climate action have the financial support they need to adapt and mitigate to climate harms.
And we come now to the final question of the evening, which comes from Anthony Helm.
Right. Thank you. Well, we've heard the candidates can talk the talk, but can you walk the walk? What hands-on environmental work have you done in the past 12 months? Or, if you've not been able to get out and put your wellies on, how otherwise have you supported practical environmental volunteer projects?
And we'll go with Simon first.
Thanks, Anthony, and thank you for all the work you do with the tree groups in St Albans. Personally, I've mentioned a couple of them. So I've been talking to the water companies and raising awareness and campaigning on the issue of specifically of abstraction of water from the river. But I'm glad to see that is changing. And that Affinity Water are abstracting less from the River Ver. They're still abstracting in the wrong place. If John was here now, he would be nodding furiously, I'm sure. So there's that. I mentioned the tree campaign. So the council through Hertfordshire and the local council were chopping down hundreds of trees last year with no local cooperation or consent, which Chris was really pleased because he hates trees. And so I got some publicity for that and got on the media. And it just helps to raise the issues, and say actually people feel very passionately about their local trees. I recently invested in an e-bike, which means that some of those occasions where I might have driven, I can now go up hills that I wasn't capable of cycling up on my normal push bike. And as a result of my huge enthusiasm for that, as I also mentioned earlier, I'm now talking to the local e-bike companies in Hertfordshire to see if we can extend that scheme into St Albans. I'm a huge convert for that. So hopefully that's a little sample of what I've been doing.
Thank you, Simon. Sophia.
So as a working mum with two young children and a commute, I spend most, and a school governor and a non-executive director of Amnesty International and a voluntary lead on three justice projects. I have a lot of time spare, or not, as the case may be. But what do I do? So I would split so I judge what I do by the impact I have. So I've chosen a career in sustainability in the world of UN SDGs and global impact as being the place where I can have real life impact. And I've spent the last 25 years pushing forward those. Most recently, I was the global head of purpose and impact at an international law firm where I helped both clients, but also the law firm itself and many other organizations across the sector to meet the challenge of either climate change or indeed biodiversity and so on. I currently lead as a pro bono effort two environmental projects. One is designed to deliver commitment to the 1.5 Paris Accord for all law firms across, we're starting in the UK, we may get global, who knows. And the other is actually to raise 1 million hours of intellectual capital from across the legal sector to arrest climate change, biodiversity decrease and so on. That's what I do, because that's the way in which I can deliver the greatest impact. In my spare time, we litter pick, we do the beach cleans, and we plant trees locally. We also have an allotment. I hardly ever use a car. I use a train absolutely everywhere.
Daisy.
Well, on a personal level, in the last 12 months, I'm lucky enough and privileged enough to be able to get solar panels on my house and to move to a hybrid car. I planted some trees with some of the local scout groups in St Albans. I visited the greenhouse. I think Duncan's here somewhere, possibly with Tricia as well, which is the environmental activist group on London Road. I visited the Redbourne Golf Club, where they're doing a lot of restoration work with the River Ver and working with farmers. And off the back of that, I wrote a letter to the Environment Agency with some very specific, detailed questions about some technical problems they were having up there. What else can I say? For those of you who missed what Simon was saying about trees, this was a very naughty campaign that Simon ran last year, saying that we should save the trees, when in fact the only trees that were earmarked for being cut down were trees that posed a risk to life because they were dying or diseased. So this local council has planted thousands of trees, so that was a little bit naughty. But anyway, I thought I'd just correct the record on that front. Anyway, as I say, I've done lots of things in terms of getting my hands dirty locally, planting trees with the scouts, visiting the River Ver, but also crucially using my position in the Houses of Parliament to advocate for more work to protect the River Ver, to protect our green spaces as well.
James.
So my day job, I work for a charity called One Young World, and the whole purpose of what we do is we connect the next generation of world leaders from every country on the planet so that they're working together before they get their leadership roles. And one of the big things we do is connect climate activists all over the world to make sure that the climate activism they're doing is joined up everywhere. And I meet some of the most fantastic and inspiring people from every single country in the world are doing this. But on a personal level, one of the big things that I am obsessed about with my sort of local authority wonkish policy head on is circularity and creating circular economies. And one of my proudest achievements when I had the portfolio in Westminster City Council is when we bought our fleet of fully electric bin lorries, and it was me who had the idea to buy the plot of land next to the incinerator where the rubbish is taken. And we ran a cable from the electricity generator there, and we created a parking lot, and it became the first self-powering bin fleet in maybe, definitely Europe, most probably the world. So there's one of the things that I'm really pleased that I did when I was a councillor.
Thank you, James. Now, because Simon was accused of being naughty, I'm going to give him a moment to respond.
Thank you. All I need is a moment, because the shame about the trees in St Albans is that most of them get turned into leaflets for Daisy.
I'm asking you to respond to the suggestion.
That's my response.
Okay. Then, okay. In that case, we'll draw that to a close before it turns nasty. Well, look, before we say thank you to the candidates, I would like to say thank you to the organisers of this event and to the people who have been doing the videoing, the sound production, the photography this evening, and everybody else who's helped to bring it together. So I hope we can all thank them. And finally, I think I'm in awe of people who can speak passionately about what they really believe in, whether we believe it or not, and can stop the moment a bell is rung, which I absolutely could not. So I want to thank all of the candidates for coming this evening in very busy schedules, and I hope you'll thank them with me.
Will you just join with me to have a big round of applause to Nick Hazelthorpe?
Thank you.